right, just give me a couple. Hello again, here it is Greg Berger along with Rick Moore on Unfinished Music at MSONewsportsRadio.com or Newsports.
It's MSO Radio and Video, but it's MSONewsports.com. That's the website.
There you go. And today our guest is someone whose name has been mentioned here almost as much as Greg and Rick, and that's Tony Gaudis. Welcome, Tony Gaudis.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
No problem.
It's nice to see that you really exist, because all these guys have come in and mentioned you all. You know, every week we get somebody in here.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Cool. And your last name is really?
Yep. Russian name. I'm sure it was changed when the great grandfather came over, but no one in my family really seems to know what it might have been.
I gotta look that up. That's a very unique name, especially for these parts.
Yeah. I'm from Delaware originally, but it's just a unique name in general.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, first of all, we appreciate you coming in. It's been a long time. I think I talked to you when I first started, before I went on the air, having you on as a guest. So it's almost a year, but hey, better late than never.
Great.
So we're here to talk about what you've got going on, what you had going on. You've got an eclectic list of songs that you sent, things you've been involved with. So why don't we just start with the question that I usually ask people who are not from Gloucester. What brought you up this way?
My band in the 90s had a small record deal, and we had rehearsed and recorded in the house we all lived in while we went to college. Mm-hmm. And I had to find a place where we could rehearse and record now that we had graduated. And I had no idea. I'd never been to Gloucester before. And I just lived right down the road on Concord Street. I found a place out in the woods on 17 acres and made our second and third records there. And I'm so thankful, you know, like we had a lease for a place in Sturbridge Village. And I don't think the band would have survived if we had moved out there. And yeah, it was just totally chance to wind up moving here. I would more often go into Essex than onto the island to do anything.
But, how'd you get started? Now, you said college. Is that where you sort of put the thing together?
That band, yeah. I mean, I was just always been obsessed with music. But that was a band that started during, you know, my freshman or sophomore year of college. And
where were you? What school?
Tufts.
At Tufts, okay.
Yep. And, you know, we would make recordings on our cassette four tracks and would, you know, make copies and decorate them and give them to friends.
So what did you have for a setup? What was your first setup like? Because everything now is so, I mean, I've seen pictures of your studio now and it's like mind blowing. Yeah. So what was it like to begin with?
Oh my gosh. It was just one of those Tascam Porta 424, I think, cassette four track with a couple 57s.
Yeah.
And then we got a record that we had pressed up a 45 off of one of those recording sessions. And that whole time we would book tours to New Orleans and back or out to Chicago and back. Yeah, we were, I can't believe how much energy I had as a 19, 20. I mean, I can believe it. I wish I had that energy now. And then we got a small record deal and we got an 8-track tape machine, half inch 8-track, a small mixing board, and a condenser microphone, AKG 414. And that's how we made that first record. But we would always mix them in a, you know, a quote-unquote professional studio.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I guess because we were into making the records ourselves whenever I had some extra money. And, you know, it's a purchase for work. You know, it's tools of the trade. So I was always buying mics and stuff. And once the band ended, you know, transitioned to recording other people more and amassing more and more equipment, I guess.
Yeah, that's cool. How'd you get started in music in the first place?
Just, you know, there was a piano in the house growing up. My dad's acoustic guitar was kicking around. I just loved it. And, you know, it was Rush, I must say, was the first band.
Got the poster right there?
Yeah.
You know, that's funny. I forget to ask people about that because, excuse me, the first piece of music that I owned that was mine as a kid, I will never forget, was Satisfaction by the Stones, because other than that, it was my mother's Elvis Presley or my dad's Glenn Miller, but it was Satisfaction. And so it was Rush for you? That's what you remember?
I think so. It might have been Pac-Man Fever or some novelty hit, but I remember hearing Tom Sawyer at summer camp and saying, "Mom, take me to the grocery store. I have to get this music." Because, yeah, you know, I did know my dad's Stones record collection and the Beach Boys and stuff, but this was the first music that was nothing like anything I'd heard in the house. And I don't think MTV had launched yet. Maybe it was just coming around.
Yeah, about 82, something like that.
Was it that early, really?
Yeah. Tom Sawyer was 81, right?
Yeah.
So, so we went to the grocery store. I got Moving Pictures, and it went from there, my first concert. And I'm glad that they were my first band in that they had this big catalog already. So music instantly became this, oh, man, I heard there's this album called 2112 that's even cooler. And, you know, it automatically, it had that whole, I don't know, mystery and history that you could delve into. You know, I think shortly after that, Def Leppard Pyromania came out. And I, of course, got into that like every other teenage boy, but they only had two albums. It wasn't as exciting as Rush that had 12 albums. And
yeah, that's right, because by the time Rush was mainstream, it was probably their, I don't know, their 12th album.
Yeah.
12th album. So, that's when I first heard them. We used to hear them on the bus driving to middle school. The bus driver had it, and we'd hear Tom Sawyer every day. It was unbelievable.
And every kid in band at school had to get behind the drum kit and try and play that drum beat. But, I loved all the classic Led Zeppelin, Black Sabbath, Rolling Stones, but then speed metal took over my life. And then speed metal was this kind of underground thing where there was these small bands that were actually playing at the club down the street from where I grew up, you know, and that was the first music that really felt, you know, maybe I could participate in this. And then I guess just more and more aggressive music, more obscure music. And that led me to some music where part of it was knowing that they recorded themselves on four tracks and things like that. So getting into recording myself and then reading about the Beatles and the Beach Boys recording on four tracks. Mm-hmm. And that kind of turned my head around because, like, oh, wait a second. I've been making this kind of dissonant, not that pleasing music. Kind of because I could never make a really high fidelity sounding record because we're just working on four tracks. But then finding out that Sgt. Pepper's was four track, you know, kind of opened my ears more to the Beatles and made me up my game, I guess.
When you record something, there's so many places to go here, but when you record either your own stuff or someone else's stuff, how do you decide when this is it, it's right, it's done? Because I know people who produce films and they're never satisfied. No, we got to redo this, we got to recut it, we got to do this, we got to re-edit. Yeah. Is it the same way in music, or you just say, look, that's it, this is a good sound, there's an intrinsic thing there?
Well, for myself, because I own the studio, it's never done. I can always go back in, but...
Yeah, but you know what I'm trying to say, a satisfaction thing where the art is finished type thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think when we're doing a mix, when you've kind of brought the song up to the level it needs to be, you can just kind of, and that's all you're doing is you're hitting play in every moment where your pulse drops or your energy sags. What's going on? I got to fix that. And eventually you get to the end of the song and you feel like you've made every moment count, and then you know you're done.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it depends on your approach. If you're going to capture a moment of people playing music together, then it's a lot easier to say, hey, that was the moment. We captured it, for better or for worse.
Right.
We can polish it a bit, but that was the energy in the room. Whereas if you're doing the approach where everyone's overdubbing and overdubbing, then it really does.
Just rehearsed everything, yeah.
Well, speaking of catching the energy, why don't we hit up, you mentioned your band. You didn't mention the name, though, Papas Fritas.
Yep.
So, interesting name, but while Rick's queuing up...
Yeah, because we got to get into those names, yes, absolutely.
So, The Way You Walk, is it?
Sure.
I love that song, I love the video. But for those out there who don't know what Papas Fritas means, it is...
It's Spanish for French fries.
There you go.
All right.
So here's Papas Fritas and The Way You Walk.
I can tell by the way you walk, you wanna be alone with him. 'Cause you're pacing at an open door, you're waiting and he can come in. Decided for me. I can tell by the way you walk, you wanna be alone with him.
We're back, and that was The Way You Walk by Papas Fritas, and we're here again with Tony Gaudis, and excellent song.
Thanks, man.
So what was the writing process like in Papas Fritas?
That was, I usually, you know, I had a little cassette boombox next to the bed, and would just make up melodies and things, just little seeds of songs. Mm-hmm. And then usually once I had 20 or 30 of them, the band would get together and just kind of kick them around.
Yeah.
And that, then we were kind of a democracy. Oh, I like that one. Oh no, that's too this. I don't want to do that. So we'd kind of whittle it down, and then I'd go back and try and finish those bits. And if it was a song where we had earmarked it for the drummer to sing, then she might take it and finish some melodies and finish some lyrics, things like that. Like that song, I wrote it all, and Shivika, I think, got like 5% credit because she, I think, like we were recording it, and I was like, can anyone think of a better line here? And she came up with a line. But there's like a few other songs on that record where I had the title and the chorus and like just a melody for the verse, and she wrote the lyrics, that kind of thing. So that's generally how it worked.
Yeah. You talk about kicking it around. Is that fun? I mean, that can be creative and a lot of fun. It doesn't have to be stressful, does it, when you're putting something together?
No, and that, in fact, that record, more than the other ones, we did try and just sit there and write lyrics together. A few of the songs, we kind of had the idea of what it was about, and we just threw lines out.
Is that right?
Yeah, and then we just, I like that one. Oh, that one's silly, and just kind of cross them out until we had it done. Yeah, because we wanted the band to represent us, not just one person. And
how many were in the band? I'm not familiar with Papa Fritas.
Three of us.
Three of you. Okay, yeah. So the Rush element of the trio thing. I got it. Okay, Papa's Fritas. All right, and that's a unique sound. How do you pigeonhole that? What do you how do you describe that particular sound? Because it's upbeat. It's certainly not heavy metal rocker or folk singer. How do you describe that, or do you? Just let it go.
Yeah, I mean, I think we just considered ourselves pop music. And at the time in 94, And when the band was coming out, I mean, that was, there wasn't a lot of that. Like, popular music was ruled by the bands like Creed and Stone Temple Pilots. And,
yeah.
You know, when the, around when the band was ending was when the boy band era came on so strong with Backstreet and Britney and pop. We wound up touring with the band The Cardigans. That was really cool because they were very much a pop band and they had a number one record while we were on tour with them.
Is it Breathless? Was that their song? Leaving Breathless? Was that The Cardigans?
Love Fool?
Were they Irish or?
Swedish.
Swedish. Okay. Yeah. Somewhere on the other side of the ocean.
Yeah.
It's all the same.
But, you know, just pop, rock.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. We like the Beatles and the Beach Boys and Fleetwood Mac. And
but what was, so what was touring like on that, in that particular era?
It was fun. You know, we did reunite in 2011 to do some shows and doing interviews around that. The main thing I realized is it was before the internet and before cell phones. So we were always looking for payphones. Oh, we got to call the club. We're gonna.
What's a payphone? Yeah.
We got to call the club and tell them we're running late. Or, hey, does anyone know if we get dinner tonight? You know, if the place has food.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I got to get something to eat now. So we were constantly looking for payphones. And it was really exciting because you had no idea. You just had this address for, you know, some. We played some, like, garage park in Salt Lake City, Utah. It just popped into my mind, but just, you don't know. I mean, eventually, if you've toured the U.S. a few times, maybe you're going back to some of the same clubs, some of the same cities, but, you know, yeah, it could be, it was just exciting.
Absolutely.
You just didn't know what what's this place going to be like? What are the citizens going to be like? How are you being treated? Whereas now, you know, you could log on. They probably have a Facebook page. There's reviews. Yeah, we would go to AAA and get those maps made for routing your trip.
Yep. Yeah.
We had to, you know, we doled out responsibilities with touring, and so one person was in charge of directions because if you had three, and we always had someone else riding with us for to help out, you know, if four people are trying to look at the map and have different opinions, it just was chaos. So just one person, right or wrong.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that was... It was really, I always say it was a great way to spend my 20s. But in the U.S., we were always just sleeping on people's floors and, you know, friends and relatives. Our last album, we were staying in hotels. And then when we were over in Europe, we were always staying in hotels and we had someone else driving by and large.
Nice.
But, you know, that always seemed like the big transition. If you get to the level where you can afford a tour bus, then it would be a much more sustainable lifestyle because, you know, you have a place to sleep and shower. And but, you know, a tour bus is a very expensive proposition. So, you know, these bands get much more successful, but they aren't making any more money because it's all going right back into the band. But, yeah, it was four kids in a van driving around, sleeping on people's floors. So it was a lot of fun.
That's funny. We had to go down to Philadelphia recently, and my daughter, who's a high school senior, navigated. She was the navigator in the front seat. And we're going over the George Washington Bridge, whatever it was. And I'm thinking, we're going to get killed. I mean, we just don't know where we're going. Trust me. Trust me. And she's got, you know, the Siri or whatever the hell it is going. And she got us there. And I'm thinking, because I was talking about, we got to get a map. We got to get a map and route it out like we used to do.
Yeah.
And now you don't need to, obviously. But that kind of life experience, you know, when you talked about climbing the ladder, it's interesting because I as a former high school teacher, kids always see the glitzy, the golden side, the MTV side. But it is, I'm glad you pointed out, as you climb, as you get more successful and make more money, you also have to spend more, I guess, too. And you've got to invest in equipment and gear and lodging and everything else.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you spend a little, your quality of life, maybe you want to try and improve it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, you can hire a lot of people to tune your guitars for you and stuff. but you know, I mean, the band, you know, we were a post-Nirvana band, so kids with guitars, you thought there was a way to make a living, but really, we didn't have any real, there was no aspiration to make it big. I mean, we wanted to just do it. We wanted to just be able to do it. But then we hit our mid to late 20s and, you know, then you know, we didn't go through that thing after college. What am I going to do with my life? We already knew we're going to go on tour and we're going to make a record and just kind of, I don't know. But then eventually people, hey, I think I want to go back to school or I want to have a family or, you know, so.
Interesting.
Yeah, we weren't, there was never any real hope of glitz and glamour.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the littlest bit because Nirvana had kicked that door down for a few years there, but it was really just about doing it.
So who went where? I mean, you're still in music and very successful and making a life of it, and loving it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the other guys, I was the real eat, breathe, and sleep music. The woman who played drums, I had actually grown up with her in high school, and she thought it'd be a fun thing to do. And then, you know, she's first generation Indian. So her folks were always, what are you doing, Shivy? You're, you know, their idea of playing at bars was the scene in Blues Brothers where they're the chicken wire thing. Yeah,
good old Blues Brothers
but,
boys.
You know, we got to be on MTV a few times and they, you know, they got to see us on TV and I think, all right, you know, and we had a song in a TV commercial that each made us, you know, $5,000 and we were like, all right, that's a living. and so we just kind of kept plugging away at it. But ultimately, and they, Shiv and Keith, the bass player, they were pretty hip to computers early on. So we would come off tour and they would be designing websites in 1994, 1995. Ooh. So, and I would come back and work in record stores. I worked at Mystery Train here. And so she still does web design. And he went back to school and became an architect and works for his father's architect firm. And he's in Houston, Texas, where he grew up.
That's cool. That is cool.
See? Yeah. Now, talk about the glitz and glamour. You had a little bit with the reunion on Yo Gabba Gabba, so that sort of introduced you to a whole new fan base, I would assume.
I guess so.
Rick probably isn't familiar with the show, but can you tell us how that came about?
They were super fans. There's nothing more. They got in touch for their first season and said, hey, we know you guys aren't around anymore, but would you record a song for this TV show? I said, oh, we aren't really around anymore, but we live so far away, but I could do a song, so I recorded a song for them. And then, I don't know, was that 2008? I don't know when Yo Gabba Gabba started.
It was somewhere in that 2008, 9, 10 range.
Then this really cool festival in Spain asked us to get back together, and it was significant enough that we were able to put together a little tour around that. We did that, and then Yo Gabba Gabba got into, hey, you got back together to do this tour. Now will you do the show? Of course, the show is more successful. The drummer's kids watched the show, and she would just, they're all about doing it, and so yeah, that was a lot of fun to do that. They, you know, those guys, they're all LA folks. They saw us every time we were in town, you know, starting from 1995. They could, I saw you here. It's really, really flattering.
Well, in the show, as when we were talking the other day, my daughter's really into it, and she's 22. You know, so it's not just little kids sitting around. You know, it appeals because of all the bands. I mean, yeah. Mother's Vow's on it a lot, and a lot of
Liz Marquis.
Yeah, so there's a lot of people that are of interest to not just 4-year-olds, but 24-year-olds. Yeah. So why don't we hit up one of those tunes from Yo Gabba Gabba?
But home, that's the problem.
You
got to
help me out here, because what am I looking at? I'm looking at
Yo Gabba. The title is Yo Gabba, right?
No, I don't have that. I have one. Hold on. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I got 9 songs that help me out. What am I? I don't have Yo Gabba Gabba.
Oh, it's one of the 9.
No, it isn't.
All right, well, we can... why don't we play another tune, and then we can, while that's playing, we can do a little search.
All right, you guys can yell at me for screwing up. All right, so give me something to play here.
Play Papa Sarita's Live by the Way.
I will do it. Let's get that on, and then I'll see if I can find what's missing here.
We've been living in the city such a long time. You and I should live by the water. Shape up and you'll fill out, and we could buy a house, maybe even have us a daughter. 'Cause the city brings the man out in the man, and it makes it hard for me to understand your feeling. I'm so tired of catching trains and coming home late. I might even try and cook dinner.
I'll make contacts in the trees, the boss says I could. He thinks I should live by the water. Cause the city brings the man out in the man, and it makes it hard for me to understand your feelings. Cause the city brings the man out in the man, and it makes it hard for me to understand your feeling. Shut the door and dim the light, fix yourself a drink. I got something you should consider. We've been living in the city such a long time. Maybe we should live by the water. Cause the city brings the man out in the man, and it makes it hard for me to understand. Yes, it makes it hard for me to understand your feelings.
Back
and I found Papa Frieda Snake. Okay. Now wait a minute. Where did it go? Hold on. What's the name of the song? I just
put it on. Home.
Okay, home, and it says okay. All right, I do have it.
We're gonna jump right into home. Let's go home.
Okay.
We're gonna sing a song about a happy place, loving place. It's where we live and play. It's where we all end up at the end of the day.
Hey, we're back, and we found our way home. So you've had a lot of things going on. We mentioned the studio, because give a plug to that. All the other guests have did not anyway, but Bang a Song Studios.
He didn't need to talk about the studio, because everybody else has.
Yeah, that was recorded there. Bang a Song, it's under the CVS on Main Street. 32 channels of...
Oh, so when I go in, that's what I'm hearing. Okay, I got it now. I didn't know that. Okay, cool. That's quite a place. And how long have you had that?
I think I've been down there for about 10 years now.
Wow.
Was that your first professional put-together studio where you made other people come in? Or?
For a little while, I was down in Davis Square in Somerville. That was, it's always been in my house. And then the Davis Square was the first time that it was... in a, a business location. And then, And I never really set out to, it was just kind of a byproduct of being in bands and having friends in bands. Oh yeah, let's record you guys. Let's record you guys. And it's only, since I set up here that it's more, recording anyone who comes in and all stripes.
So what's that process like? Tell me about it. How does that work? You guys know I don't.
I mean, a lot of times it's really just, hey, I've got a band. Can we come in and record? We set up a time. I usually find out the instrumentation, guitar, bass, drums, etc. And then I just try and be as ready as I can for when they show up, mm-hmm. and we just hit record and kind of see what happens. It's rare that people want to hire a producer mm-hmm. who would come in and say, hey, that intro's too long, and
right.
all these songs are in the same key and the same tempo. And we usually just kind of record them and then take it from there.
Kind of direct to digital, just bang, and that's it, like a live recording, essentially.
Yeah, well, that's the first night, the first session, mm-hmm. and then it's like, well, I guess I'll have talked to them too. Oh, we really want to, some people, we just want to capture what we do. We don't want all the bells and whistles. Some people, we want to, you know, cut the basics, and then I'm going to bring in a string section, and I'm going to bring in, you know, backing singers and all that stuff. It really varies. It depends
That's cool.
on who it is. But I'd say a lot of times it is just, the band comes in, we hit record and see what we get. And that's our, you know, that's the start of the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And we might, you know, expand from there. But there's certainly artists like John Butcher who comes in, who's, you know, been doing it his whole life and has a vision and has a real plan for what he wants to accomplish. And we're just the engineers facilitating.
How does, so the mixing and stuff and the directing or producing, is that something that you studied or you picked up by your musicianship over the years and then you incorporated into producing?
It's just picking it up mm-hmm. from doing it. Yeah. I never went to a recording school. You know, I would love to study it, but, you know, back when I was starting, I was a little more, I don't know, anti-authority. Just, I'm going to do it my way, and that's going to be original because I don't know what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. But then eventually you know, like I was saying, getting into the Beatles and realizing they're on four tracks and they're kind of inventing the whole
right,
ball
right.
game as they go along. You kind of, it's like you got to learn the rules to break them. I didn't know the rules in the beginning, so I was just breaking them. And maybe it was a little yeah. more original because of it. Because I wasn't trying to get a great Beatles drum sound or something, and then eventually you're trying to cop some of the sounds from your favorite records. But, and you know, engineering is a kind of a specific science of microphone technique, and yeah, just kind of being the master of all this signal flow, whereas producing is just this kind of subtle art of keeping people comfortable and keeping them relaxed and keeping things from not getting bogged down and being able to make decisions when you see that something is kind of at an impasse.
But you do both. So you're engineering and your work in the band as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd say so.
Cool.
Now that I've got a great engineer named Warren Babson, local boy, in case you didn't know.
Mm-hmm. Babson, yeah.
and I love it when we can work together, where he's more of the engineer and I can produce and the producing is kind of, you know, if the band has set the tempo and the key for the song, that's just, you know, some basics of just making sure the song's in the right key for the performers, the right tempo to kind of get across. But then, you know, keeping track of it. Take one, you didn't really have the groove till the second chorus, but from then on, that is the take. And then we can grab, you know, the first verse from take two and the first chorus from take three and, you know, edit them together. So kind of keeping copious notes about what's been accomplished and being able to make those decisions. And, you know, just having the experience of saying, you know, what's really going to embellish this nicely is if you double track that guitar part in a different octave. Or so I guess arranging is part of it, too. There's a lot of little hats to be worn. But
yeah. If someone wants to get in the studio, bangasong.com. What's the...
Yeah, bangasong.com.
Bangasong.com. And just quick station ID here. So this is Greg Verger along with Rick Moore on msonewsports.com. We're at Unfinished Music, and today our guest is Tony Gaudis. And hello again, Tony.
Hello.
So you've, in the last year or so, took over the space down there as well. So you're... For the practice space, you want to give a little plug to that side of the business?
Yeah, that's called Gloucester Rehearsal Studios. And that was just, I was a tenant along with about 10 other rehearsal rooms of another landlord. And when they stepped down, I stepped up. And yeah, we've got a bit of a waiting list now. But it's, I'm sure a lot of people have this experience of being in CVS on Main Street and hearing some rumbling. What is that?
I love
that?
It. That's yeah. cool. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in fact, at the recording studio, we're rarely the ones making, you know, maybe on the basics, you know, when the full band's playing together, right. it might be a bit loud. But after that, it's just one little part at a time. It's not that loud. It's, you know, it's the heavy metal band practicing out on a Tuesday night. But yeah, so Gloucester Rehearsal Studios. People can get in touch through Bang a Song. And yeah, the demand is there. I would love to be able to have more rooms. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, we'll wind up with a jam spot type room where people who want to just rent the room by the hour and they come in and there's already a drum kit, there's already amplifiers, a PA. So you just come in with your instrument, plug in and play, as opposed to the full, you know, signing a lease, renting it month by month and all that. But.
Excellent. Yeah. And the noise, I mean, because when I was there with Moonraker, we'd be playing and then we'd hear the band, we'd stop between songs, we'd hear the band across the hall. But it was great. Just the cacophony was, I thought it helped the whole process.
I really, you know, there's tons of them down in Boston, Cambridge, Alston, Somerville, the music complex, the rehearsal complex. I remember the first time going in one, just thinking it was so cool. It was just like this rock and roll dormitory or rock and roll, you know, just, yeah, that whole thing of, man, we're stuck next to this insanely loud band and we're trying to do country covers. But it just, it was fun. And yeah, Gloucester, I guess, just doesn't have one of those. So it's a bit of one. It's a small scale one. But yeah, we've got John Jerome. We used to have Moonraker. We've got John Barry. We've got the Heavy Denims. We've got the Instinct. We've got Will Hunt and his studios. Under Griffin's Porch, they just broke up. I can't remember what the bands that have spun out of that are.
But you've added some space since Moonraker was like November. We disbanded. So you added where John is. Isn't that new space? Which was just a pile of junk when I was going in there.
We cleaned out a lot of junk so that John could move in there. But that's it.
Yeah,
that's it. Yeah, nice. Moonraker. Now it's, I don't know the names of the bands, but there's about three bands in that room. They just painted it, actually. That guy Keen is been doing a nice job.
Excellent. Yeah, because, well, I tell you, but my wife might want us out of here sometime because we'll be playing and I'll go up and she's way up on the third floor watching TV because it doesn't work out for her on the second floor, on the main floor, I mean. So, all right, well, why don't we hit up one of your other songs? You have a lot of projects on here from your past. Is this one you'd like to focus on?
Let's play the Butcher song.
Great.
He, you know, the first time he came in the studio, this is the first song we ever did together, and it blew my mind because I knew John Butcher as a guitar hero. I knew he was going to come in and play awesome guitar. Had no idea what a singer he was.
Yeah.
He might have already had the bait, you know, the drums and bass on tape. We did some guitars. He said, "All right, set up a vocal mic." And he walked out and he just blew my mind. No warm up. It's just so soulful, so commanding. To me, he's every bit as much of a singer as a guitar player, even though he's famous for the guitar playing. But
and he produced Megan Wolfe, who we had in here. Right?
Yep.
So
absolutely.
She recorded her album at your studio? Yep. Yeah, okay. Yep. All right, so let's hear John Butcher.
Suddenly I saw a monster. And there's a bone buried in the barnyard. I'll be digging up that prize, digging up that prize. And I can tell by the way, I can tell by the way you know me. Yeah, I can see it in your big brown eyes.
John Butcher, produced by, or produced with,
engineered by,
engineered by.
Yeah. John Butcher gets the production.
Explain that, because you were just explaining that off the air to a neophyte like myself, and to explain that whole process right there, because I was just asking I was asking Tony about the balance and what it sounds like from a one performer's viewpoint versus what you're hearing sitting getting everybody coming in. So explain that process and how John Butcher does it and so on.
Well, John, you know, very much has a vision and so knows, you know, yeah, really, he comes in and, you know, it's almost like he has a checklist. He doesn't literally have it written down, but he knows the things he wants to accomplish. And so I'm just trying to facilitate that and be set up as quick as possible. And sometimes he'll say, oh, what do you think of this sound? Or, you know, do you think I should double track this line? But yeah, really, John is absolutely his own producer, deciding whether something's in the pocket or in tune. And, you know, he might say, I want this guitar to sound 10 feet tall and I have to try and accomplish that for him. Or I want this guitar to sound like Angus Young. And we might, he's actually never said that to me, but you know what I mean? Like,
I want to be there for that.
Yeah. But yeah. So in that case, engineering is just keeping it moving along as quick as John wants to move and being able to dial up these sounds that he wants quickly. And it's a good relationship.
Well, why don't we play a couple of, we could do a couple of samples of tunes. These are available at bangasong.com or
I think they're streaming at Bangasong, and all these artists are on, you know, your Spotify. They were available on CD at some point.
Okay. Well, we'll hear one from the Rudds and the Silver Lining.
Yeah, that'd be great.
And then a bit of Willie Loco Alexander.
Heaven's on our side. What cannot be taken away? The temple outside me. In me, I am inside of. What cannot be taken away? The temple outside me. In me, I am inside of. Temple outside me, in me, I am inside of, I am inside of. Be taken away, the temple outside me, in me, I am inside of.
All right, so that was Willie Loco Alexander, and we're going to talk about
that
the
was
process.
Different.
Yeah. Yeah. Whew. Yeah, so that first band was a band called The Silver Lining. We're a wonderful group that were the principal singers and songwriters were out of Rochester, New York. And that track I wanted to play because that is them totally live in the studio, not a single overdub. The vocal, the harmony vocal, the guitar, piano, bass, drums, all totally live. And I thought they just got a great energy. That was the last track on their second record. And so, yeah, that's we were talking in between about when I first started recording and having a multi-track, it was really about using the tape machine as a canvas of experimenting with arrangements and different textures until, you know, the song was just kind of the canvas to hang all this experimentation on. And then the Megawatt Blues Crushers came into my recording studio once and just basically threw a party in the studio. And you could feel that energy coming off the tape. Because so many times when you're just doing it piecemeal, experimenting, I mean, you can get some real special energy, but you can also just get some stuff that's just, I don't know, it's a little lifeless. Mm-hmm. It's just all cerebral as opposed to physical. And so the Megawatts were just physical. And it was just a wonderful, I want to make more music like this of people that just come in and get down. So this band, The Silver Lining, were really capable of that, and I think that was a great one. And then Willie Alexander, who you guys know, being a Gloucester guy, that I would say Willie and I produced the records together, though I think ultimately he deserves the final production credit, because that is, he'll come in that track, he came in with that percussion loop. I'm not sure what it is. I think him and Doc Vincent from the Megawatts made it. And then he'll improvise some piano over it, or he's just got a chord progression that he likes, and we'll record that and maybe move it around. And then that was, he made this amazing record where he took Vincent Farini's poems and turned them into melody and songs. Not just, a lot of people think, oh, it's poems and music, it's just going to be spoken word, but he actually created melody and songs from them. And so that's just this real, that is kind of manipulating stuff on the canvas, kind of seeing what sticks and trying ideas. But we were able, when we've recorded together, just about every day, he would come in, you know, say at 2 p.m. and leave at 6 p.m. with the final mix, that whole album. There might have been a song or two where he went back and added an element or tried a second mix, but it was really satisfying. Of it's that approach of being more painterly, more of a canvas, but still trying to work with that speed and energy and kind of, well, let's just get it done and we'll see what we have once it's done, as opposed to worrying about too much, you know, just going for the process and more than the product. And yeah, I really love the records I've made with Willie.
All right. Well, we're going to segue into after Papa's Fritas. You started writing with other people. One example is Amsterdam, which is a song I love. We used to cover it in Moonraker, so ka-ching, ka-ching for you every time we played it. But
I hope so.
So why don't you talk about that? Because you guys were all Tufts folks, right?
Yep. We all went to school together. We weren't rivals by any means, but I think they just had a lot of success playing, you know, getting lots of people to come out to see them and playing on campus and traveling to other colleges, whereas we were kind of more seen as a, you know, we would get good, Guster didn't really get reviews back. They were playing, you know, at college campuses, whereas we were getting a cool review in Spin Magazine or something. Oh. So we were like, how did you guys, you know, make a living? And they're like, how did you guys get a good review in Spin Magazine? And it was nice that ultimately, you know, we were able to kind of wind up on the same page and Papa's Fritas ended and they kept going and just had a great career. And I think their records are just better and better and better. Mm-hmm. And so that record is kind of the classic story of, you know, you have your whole life to make your first record and then your second record is, you know, you got to get it written and recorded while you're in the middle of touring your ass off to promote that first record. So, you know, they had made a great first record. I mean, they had made a few records before, but the major label album Lost and Gone Forever with, 4-3-2-1, Barrel of a Gun on it and Fa Fa.
What'd you just do?
I was just remembering the hook of the song.
Yeah, 4-3-2-1, the barrel of a gun.
It's the chorus. Okay, okay. That's cool.
But, that, you know, they came off tour and got going on this next album, and the label, and probably them too, just like, we need more songs. We need a larger group of songs to pick from. So they got, there's quite a few other writers on that record. Ben Queller, myself. Why am I blanking on other people's names? But, yeah, so that was pretty lucky. After Papa's Fritas ended, that's what I wanted to do. I didn't want to be the leader of a band ever again. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be a behind the scenes guy who could write with someone or play bass for someone, or, you know, I just love all the music. You know, I just want to participate. And when you're the leader of a band, you aren't actually, and you have to spend all this time on tour, there's not that much music going on. If we weren't an improvising band, so we were playing, there was some variety in the set list, but you're kind of just almost just kind of performing an exercise of going out and playing the songs and putting on a good show. But there's not the kind of creativity of, hey man, I've got a gig on Thursday night, you know, three sets, the songs are pretty straightforward. Are you up for it? And I just love the challenge of that, you know. And I guess in the time I was more about, oh, I just want to, I have a vision, I'm going to do it. But then I realized just, I like it all, and there's something noble about being able to know the craft and know the, you know, the tenets of music enough that you can communicate with other guys and kind of, you know, like if you're building a house, you can just hire a good carpenter and you can kind of look, these are the draft plans. You're going to be able to execute that because I'm going to execute this. Mm-hmm. That's what, you know, good musicians can get together and kind of,
that's
without
too
much work. Yeah. You know, this is the song. It's in the key of A. Think we can get to the end of it? Yeah, I think we can. Let's do it. As opposed to, we're three people that have been living in a van for 8 years. You know, that Papa's Fritas is basically my second band. I wanted to kind of expand my horizon. So writing with Guster or a guy named Blue or a few other people and recording other people and playing, you know, just being the bass player for another guy's band. It was really...
Yeah, I mean, we'll listen to a bit of Guster, but before we get to that, I mean, I saw you invited me to a Facebook event for a Cheap Trick tribute band.
Yeah, so, play bass in a Cheap Trick cover band.
And then Safety.
80s cover band, which, you know, I hated the hated that music growing up, but now I think it's the last time popular music was any good.
Yeah, that's the music I grew up with, and then you were playing with Dave Sag the other day, so that's a regular gig with Dave and that group. So you're all over the place.
Yeah, it's a nice feeling. Like I said, when I first started going to the Rum Line, you know, maybe I was a little critical, like, oh, why are these guys just playing Pink Floyd covers? But now I don't know, I guess I've just come around. And okay, you would never catch me dead playing a Pink Floyd song, but you know, playing Chuck Berry, getting people dancing.
Yeah, I mean, you're doing like Buddy Holly.
Yeah, I love all that stuff.
Captain Tennille, that's another one you do with in the Goddesses. So why don't we play a little bit of Guster, and then we'll come back and sort of wrap it up with Goddesses and what's going on.
Guitar and Shaq CD, well, they don't mean that much to me right now. I'm going through your things these days. I'm changing all my strings. I'm gonna write you a letter. I'm gonna write you a book. I wanna see your reaction. I wanna see how it looks.
Tony Goddess. So moving on, Jenny D. Let's talk about
that. Yeah, Jenny D was just guys largely based around the recording studio Q Division down in Somerville. You know, a lot of different folks that I've been friends with for years. And originally, the bass player, who's the, Ed Velauskas, is the studio manager at Q Division. There was a the singer-songwriter Nick Lowe, his record label organized tributes to him in a bunch of major markets, you know, Boston, Nashville, Minneapolis. So they contacted him, and he put together the band for this Nick Lowe tribute. And when we did that, he said, hey, my wife wants to do a girl group. I think we'd be a good band for it. Would you guys like to do that? And we said, sure. And it was a real kind of immediate, you know, just a lot of fun. Everyone connected, and it just all lined up really well. I think our album came out in 2007, 2008. Got to go to Spain on it. A lot of fun shows here. We wound up backing being the band for Lala Brooks from the Crystals. Mm-hmm. You know, she sang "Da Do Run Run" and "Then He Kissed Me." Yeah, 2010 was the peak of the band. That year we were backing up Lala Brooks. We played this wonderful festival called the Ponderosa Stomp in New Orleans that I had actually paid to go to the year before. And it was so wonderful to actually, you know, be a guest of the festival. That
awesome.
And we apparently Peter Wolf was hip to the band, and so Peter asked the band to open the Giles Aerosmith show at Fenway. So that, of course, was a highlight. Some people say we're the first band, the first local band to play Fenway. Because I know, I think a few big people had played there. But I don't think, you know, Aerosmith and Jay Giles, that was like the first, like, real low. You know, McCartney maybe had played there. Or yeah. The Police, did they play there when they did the reunion?
And Billy Joel, Bill Springsteen. But I don't know if they had done it at that point.
Yeah. And so by being the opening band, we were the first.
Boston. Yeah, you were the first.
Yeah, there you go.
We were playing as people were, you know, coming in the broad daylight, but it was still great. And we played Symphony Hall that year too, which was an honor. That was for one of those New Year's Eve first night shows.
Cool.
But we decided we wanted to have kids, and that band played like 150 gigs a year, and then adding in rehearsals and recording sessions, it was a lot of work. You know, we played Fenway. The next day we played in Pennsylvania, and it was like, it should have been an 8-hour drive, and it was a 14-hour drive. We played to no one and then all drove back. It's like, you know, the highest high and just about the lowest low. It was just, that's the way it is. But, so that was a great band. They're still going strong. I'm sure I think Sam and I, when we perform as the Goddesses, I think we'll be opening for them at one of the Harbor Loop concerts this summer.
Oh, nice.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. So Sam is your wife.
Yep.
So, and why don't we listen to something by the Goddesses? You guys are obviously all over town.
All right. So we're not doing Jenny D. Let me find the Goddesses. Okay. Got it.
So which one?
Why don't you do I'm a Hog for You?
Okay.
Right. Yeah. And that's just us indulging our love of 50s rock and roll. Yeah. And then the guys from the 70s that were also indulging that, like your Nick Lowe's and Dave Evans. So this is a coaster song that we do.
Okay. I'm a hog for you, baby. Your love. When I go to sleep at night, you're the only thing I'm dreaming of. One little piggy ate a pizza. Yeah. One piggy ate a potato chip. Yeah. This little piggy's coming over your house. Gonna nibble on your sweet lips. Cause I'm a hardcore baby.
Okay, that was my bad.
We're going to go with Jenny D for our goodbye song, but just want to thank you, Tony, for coming by and joining
us
here.
Thanks for having us, guys. Greg, Rick.
Great meeting you, man. This is awesome.
This is a lot of fun to finally see the man that's been mentioned so many times. And
cool.
I told you he was real, Rick.
I know.
So this is Greg Berg along with Rick Moore on Unfinished Music at msonewsports.com.
We're back in a few weeks.
We'll be back in
a few weeks.
May 31st, we'll be back with Black Sheep Stampede, which is my band. So I'll be stepping aside while Alan Estes takes over as the host along with Rick Moore.
Yes.
And then coming up on our one-year anniversary, sometime around June 15, we may be
shifting that date so we can get some more players in. But it'll be Dan King, who was our very first guest, and we'll be making a special announcement. So save the date of August 27th, and there's more to follow. Here we go with Jenny D.
Heart full of promises, eyes full of tears.